Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Sleary Report someone who's going to be speaking under anonymity. His name or his handle is The Saker, and he writes at the Vineyard of The Saker, and he is the person I most read when I'm trying to understand what in the world is going on with the United States squabble with Russia, but also Russia's point of view and what is going on in Russia and how Russia sees the world. He's an accomplished military analyst, but someone who speaks with a very knowledgeable voice of Russia and Europe. And so it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Sleary Report. Saker, welcome.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. That's really my pleasure.
Well, before we start, I just want you, because it's so wonderful to read. You have a new book, and I recommend it to everybody who's interested in these topics. You describe in the book how you just started to post your thoughts about what was going on in Russia and, I guess, in the Ukraine. And this has literally exploded, and you now have people translating in many countries. This has become quite a big enterprise. But if you could maybe talk a little bit about your history and how you came to do this and how it came to grow to such a significant presence on the internet.
Yes, of course. My history is kind of really weird and unplanned at all. I am a fourth generation Russian emigre, which means that my great grandparents left Russia after the Civil War. I was born myself in Switzerland. I lived there most of my life, though I studied in the United States. So I lived in Washington, D.C. for a couple of years, got a couple of degrees there, and now I live in Florida. And I got basically my training as a military analyst, and I worked in Europe in that field. And I ran into a couple of troubles because of my politically incorrect views, particularly about the war in Bosnia. So eventually I lost my career, to make a long story short. I decided to just forget about it all, retrained as a software engineer. But then 9-1-1 put an end to that because the IT sector in Europe just collapsed. So I moved to Florida, where my wife was from, and I live here. And I began a blog just for myself, really, totally informal, writing my own things. And it was a very small blog for many years. I began that in, I think, 2007. And I had very few readers. And then suddenly, I have to say, I barely mentioned the Ukraine. I was more interested in the Middle East, actually. But then the Ukraine happened, and suddenly I was probably in a privileged position because I'm fluent in Russian. I had many contacts in Russia. Having been a Cold Warrior, I knew the Soviet system and security service and the military very well. And so it gave me a different perspective. But having studied in the U.S., I got a degree in strategic studies from Washington, D.C., and having lived in the U.S. and having been a military analyst in Europe, it also gave me a fairly good idea of what the, shall we say, the military and security complexes in the West. So I was sort of in the middle, and I could write in English. Last thing. So I began writing articles, which I would say probably reflect a Russian point of view on things. I mean, there's no doubt that I am, which is actually new for me. I used to be a flame-breathing anti-Soviet, and now I find myself thinking good things about the Kremlin, which is really counterintuitive for me, I promise you. It's even more counterintuitive to have a positive opinion of a former KGB guy like Putin, because I was raised with this idea that the KGB is, the epitome of evil. So it's very, very strange for me to be in that position. But I think I was the only blog written by a Russian that was written in English, and that helped a lot. And suddenly, truly, it exploded. People began reading more and more. And then a charming lady from France told me, I think you should also translate it in French. And I said, I can't do it. Not because I don't speak French, I do, but I don't have the time. She said, well, I'll do it. I said, okay, great, go ahead and do it. And all the other Saker blogs right now are staffed by volunteers, they're independent, and they do that just because they decide to do it. I have actually no control or input on their work at all.
Well, I'll tell you what I really most enjoy is that you don't oversimplify. So, so much of the commentary is good guy, bad guy, or I'm on this side or that side. You know, what you're exploring is lots of different points of view. You know, so for example, you go into Russia and take the different groups and different points of view. So it really breaks it down to a much more, I find, realistic commentary than most you find. And I think part of it is because you can look at it, you know, having lived in the United States, having lived in Europe, having, you know, spent time and know Russia, you can look at it from different points of view.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to me, military and national security is probably the organizing principle here. So,
well, definitely in Russia, yes.
Yeah. Well, let's go back and talk. I would love it if you would just touch a little bit on what happened in Russia in the 90s. We've had Ann Williamson on the Saleri Report, and so generally our subscribers are familiar with the story, but I was interested when I was reading your book, reading about your experiences in the 90s in Russia. So I would love it if you could touch on that as background to what's going on now.
Sure. The 90s were truly an apocalyptic period for Russia. Because basically what happened was that the elites, the Soviet elites, the Soviet Union didn't break up. It was broken up by Soviet elites, people linked to the nomenklatura, the high-level party bosses. And they split up the Soviet Union in 15 republics. And in Russia, you had basically former communists impersonating Democrats, very similar to the situation actually in the Ukraine. The Ukraine is going through what Russia, in many ways, it's similar to what happened in Russia in the 90s. And it was just an apocalyptic period. The country was led by thugs, by mafia bosses, by something called the Seven Bankers, Semi Bankirshchina, which I think just between themselves they had, I'm not sure about the figure, either 40 or more, I think it's 40 or 60% of the entire economy belonged to these seven banks. And it was a regime that was completely controlled by the United States, particularly after 1993. I mean, there was, you probably remember the first coup, that the lame attempts to restore the Soviet Union in 1991. And then there was an opposition between the parliament and President Yeltsin. And I was there during these events. I was eyewitness to all of that. And I can tell you it was very depressing because you saw on both sides former communists, both sides impersonating Democrats, and both sides accusing the other side of being fascist, which was just so just really depressing sight. And the country went through complete chaos. I truly believe that the country could have broken up and just finished its existence completely had it not been for several quasi-miraculous events, one of them being paradoxically the war in Chechnya, which frightened people into realization that, you know, Russia is about to disappear and turn into possibly have either a huge civil war turn into something like Somalia or the Ukraine today. And then, of course, the big event was the appointment of Putin, which in itself is a murky, complex issue. To make a long story short, there were two very powerful groups at the end of the 90s who realized that something had to be done. It was big business, big money, the weapons industry, oil, gas, minerals, and they pushed Medvedev as a candidate for their point of view. And the security services pushed Putin, who initially appeared as a very bleak, pretty, you know, unoriginal petty bureaucrat. And actually, I have to confess, that's the impression I got from him also when he first showed up. And he turned to be an amazing personality. I mean, I have to say, honestly, I have to think he's one of the greatest leaders that Russia ever had. And he accomplished a true miracle after he actually came to power. But the 90s were, I would compare the 90s to a war. I mean, it was, people died from not only from violence, but from poverty. It was horrible. The country was plundered. It was absolute chaos, at least as bad as what's happening in the Ukraine today.
Yeah. I noticed one commentator you were describing in the book who had said that the U.S. had kept itself funded for 10 years just by plundering Russia.
Yes. The U.S. did massively plunder Russia, absolutely. The U.S. did a big mistake. It was a short-term. The idea was to use the advantage Because at that time, not only was Russia essentially powerless, really, there was no real Russian power left, but most people were naive. I mean, they really were pro-Western, pro-American to a ridiculous degree. All Russian people wanted during these years was to, you know, become Westerners and join into the Western society. But the mistake that the West did was to try to use that and to really subdue and submit and recolonize Russia. And that's what they did. I mean, all the laws were written by Western advisors. The economy was run by Western advisors. The ministers in Russia really had no say. It was completely – Russia was run remotely, really run by the United States.
The my impression, and I don't know if it's accurate, but from the intelligence agencies, is that it was really first and foremost a Treasury covert operation. And on our side, you know, usually you think of things being run by the CIA or one of the other intelligence agencies, but this one was very much involving the Treasury covert operations. The other thing was that that they were tempted to take the whole government literally down, and then they realized they would have a problem dealing with the nuclear weapons and the existing weapon infrastructure. Because Russia, you know, right now, Russia is the second largest weapon exporter in the world. And if you look at the weapon inventory at that time, what would have happened if you literally took the country down?
That's definitely a concern. Absolutely, yes. I mean, and there was always, even in these horrible circumstances, the military did an extraordinary effort to keep at least a small core capable of functioning. And nuclear weapons were always an elite within the military. So even at the worst of time, there were functional nuclear weapons there under control. So the United States knew that there was a risk messing around with that equilibrium. Absolutely.
It's funny. Sometimes it seems like the core here in the United States is also in the military. The civic leadership we can turn to is in the military. Well, tell us, I have a theory on how the, you know, the intensity of the squabble now between the United States and Russia started. But let's start with you, because you are the knowledgeable one. I would love to hear your description of how the tension grew and got to the point that it has reached to today.
Oh, okay. Well, what happened, I think it's a situation which evolved. It didn't have to go that way at all. First of all, I would have to say that besides the military, I want to make just a little sidebar to explain Putin's background at the KGB. The KGB was a big organization. He was in part of the KGB, the first main directorate, who was actually in charge of foreign intelligence. So he had nothing to do with, you know, dissidents, concentration camps, or any of that stuff. He's really an intelligence officer. And that, within the KGB, that branch was an elite. So that's one of the two that actually survived, a core of the military and a core of the Foreign Intelligence Service. And I think initially, when they came to power, the decision was to – the hope was that the West would accept Russia as a partner. I think they really did want that. The idea was that, okay, well, you know, communism is gone. We will behave. We will help you. And they really did try to help after 9/11 in particular. We will be loyal, but you have to respect us. The minimal demand was, we are not willing to be your colony, but we're willing to be your loyal and faithful ally. But unfortunately, the West committed a series of catastrophic mistakes, including the expansion of NATO being a big one. One of the worst ones. I think the bombing of Yugoslavia was something that absolutely appalled Russians, not only the power structure, but even the people. I would mention the war in Georgia is another one that really horrified Russia, because every time the West – oh, the war in Chechnya, of course. I should not forget this one. I mean, Russians began to have a feeling that no matter what happens, the West is always against us. We'll push the advantage to the maximum and try to really destroy Russia. And I think at that point in time, people around Putin gradually began to realize that this is just not going to work. I think he also personally involved. And they came now to the conclusion that I'm pretty sure of, that they cannot function without that system. that that system as it is right now is a mortal threat to Russia. And they're pushing a different, what I call civilizational model, which is they challenge now the very principle of U.S. worldwide hegemony. They want a multipolar world. They are not accepting, they don't accept the fact that U.S. is some kind of a world hegemon in charge of security and policing. I think they're charging, they want to get rid of the economic dependence on the West because of the dollar issue, the debt. I mean, they're really, what we see now began as a disagree, as, you know, a non-acceptance of Russia as a partner, and now it has grown into basically, I think it's a war. Personally, I think Russia and the U.S. are at war. And it's a war for the future of civilization, quite literally, because the two models are incompatible, and one of them will have to collapse and be replaced by the other one. It's unclear to me which one it will be, but that's how deep it is now.
Well, let me tell you a story. I was involved for many years in very serious litigation with the Department of Justice, and it got very ugly. It was smear campaigns and physical, it was my own little war. And the way, you know, it went on for a couple of years. And normally I'm by nature not a fighter. So I was always looking for a political solution, get it settled, move on, you know, no point in fighting. No, you know, there's an old expression here, don't fight City Hall. And I was sitting in a luncheon in 1998 talking with some of my attorneys about what was going on. And I suddenly had a chill that went down my spine, and I realized I was dealing with a culture that was, do you know the story of the scorpion and the frog?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So that was a scorpion. It was debasing, you know, it's almost, you know, as an economic fact, it was essentially demonic. It didn't keep its contracts. It didn't keep its rules. It didn't respect the law. In fact, it was, you know, it was such an empty culture, and there was absolutely no point in trying to get along with it. And that's when I decided, okay, I'm going to fight, you know, because there's no, you know, this is, you're dealing with something which is so incoherent that you cannot tolerate it. There is no, you can't make a deal with it because it's basically psychopathic or nuts or, you know, whatever. But it's, you know, this, it's an issue, you know, it's much bigger than money or economics or national security, anything. You're talking about the deepest values of culture. So
I agree.
You know, it's almost a spiritual and cultural war first and foremost.
I completely agree here. Absolutely.
Right.
No doubt about it.
Right.
And I would say there's another phenomenon, which is, I'm sure you agree with that, is that these people project their own mindsets onto others. For instance, you probably remember that statement that Hillary Clinton made, I think it was in Scotland or in Ireland, that Putin is trying to rebuild the Soviet Union. You know, it's laughable. I mean, it's pathetic. I mean, you wonder who her advisors are. Russia has no need or use for a Soviet Union, as a matter of fact. And
right.
Everybody in Russia knows that. The same
right.
way, you know, this ridiculous talk today about Russia planning to either invade, sometimes they say Ukraine, now they also say Poland and the Baltics. It's laughable. But the thing is, this is what they would probably do if they changed places. Not only are they dead set on never negotiating, but only submitting people, but they assume that everybody else functions like they do.
Well, I've never quite understood it. I had an uncle who was in the Army and taught at West Point and then became a utility executive. But, you know, he occasionally would have a habit of drinking too much. And then he would tell me, you can never trust the Russians. You can never get along with the Russians. It's going to be the Russians or us. And they are the most dangerous people on the planet. Long, you know, he kind of would talk or think in 1,000-year increments. And I could never understand why he believed that. But, you know, I've just never understood the, you know, the push. Now, one of the things I wanted to bring up, if you look at the rebalancing of the global economy and the creation of WTO in the 90s, it began when we got up the GPS, Global Satellite Navigation System, which would be critical to monitoring and basically enforcing in investments. So you get that up and suddenly you can start moving a lot more money globally. We were the only one to have such a system until 2011 when Russia got theirs up. And if you look at, I don't know how they did it, but the Russians have managed to maintain significant space activities. You know, they now have more launches every year than we do. You know, they continue to be not only our biggest competitor in weapon exports, but our biggest competitor in selling space launches. And I've always wondered how much that had to do with the growth of tensions, because it looked to me like it really sort of started to get very strong at that time.
It probably was a contributing factor, but I think there's much more to it than just the space race. I think that really there is an imperial mindset. To me, the most important thing is ideology. And unlike you, my experience with U.S. military has actually been much more positive one. I used to study in Washington, D.C., and most of my teachers there were military or agencies.
Right.
And I noticed that a lot of Russia specialists in the military actually joined the military and then became Russia specialists on the job and ended up being actually very sympathetic to Russia. I saw much more hostility from the political side, including the CIA, where people joined for ideological reasons and then confirmed their own fears, you know, in their career. But the military, I've known quite a few U.S. Senior officers, and I didn't detect at that time, those the early 90s, late 80s, really much Russophobia at all. I think that the U.S. has changed. Is ruled by neocons, first of all, who are fantastically ideological. And I'm afraid that the country is less and less pragmatic and more ideological. And that's that competition, that war, really, with Russia. I think the people pushing it are really motivated by ideological, or maybe you can call it cultural, or even psychological issues that they have. Like the boogeyman and the fear, you know, of the other one, and the unwillingness to be just another nation, that desire to be, you know, exceptionalism that we even hear in Obama, you know, the indispensable nation. I think that's the real key.
It's interesting. I worked with a group of sort of quasi-neocons in the Bush administration,
mm-hmm.
and I would describe them as people who could not deal with complexity. And basically believed that their, you know, the way to accomplish something was to take it. So their belief was the way you re-engineer government is you destroy something on the theory that it's going to miraculously then sort of fix itself. And when it doesn't, you just throw billions of dollars of contracts to your friends to go fix it, which of course doesn't work.
Of course.
So, right. So part of it was they were playing with a federal credit that, you know, just, you know, wasn't connected to fundamental economics, and they could just print money. You know, as long as the empire is working, they can print money. And the problem is you can't get to any kind of accountability or productivity without the whole thing crashing, and that's an awful big crash.
Yes, and what you speak about people who can't deal with complexity, to me, it's quite amazing the change in people. I mean, I remember, you know, people like Carlucci, like James Baker, Bush Sr., and compared the abilities, just intellectual abilities of a James Baker compared to what we see today around the White House. And the Russians actually have been complaining fairly openly about that. It's rarely reported in the West. But there are many statements of Putin, Lavrov, very often, and others who basically, in polite words, say that they're dealing with idiots, incompetent.
Right.
They speak of a lack of professionalism is the euphemism they use. But I mean, it's amazing that they really think that you're dealing with intellectual midgets.
Right. It's pretty. Well, here's the thing: when you're in a unipolar world and you can run everything by force, you can, in fact, make things simple. It's very wasteful.
It's true.
But you can, in fact, make things simple. And so a switch to a multipolar world is going to be pretty shocking. Let's go back to the Ukraine. Tell us how did this How did the situation in the Ukraine start evolve? Where is it now?
Well, how did it start? How far back do you want me to go? I mean, it's been brewing since many, many years, arguably since the late Middle Ages. But I would say basically the Ukraine was, by the way, at the fall of the Soviet Union, the Ukraine was the richest and most armed and most scientifically, intellectually capable part of the Soviet Union. If I remember correctly, their GDP was higher than Poland's at that time. So it began all very well, but the problem is it was immediately taken over by, you basically have two choices in the Ukraine, crooks and Western puppets. Often they wear both hats. Basically, this country was destroyed day after day after day for ever since its independence by everybody. I mean, there wasn't a single leader right there that would even be halfway decent. And ever since the coup against Yanukovych, so there's a new element now, which is Nazis. So now we have Western puppets, corrupt oligarchs, and Nazis. And, of course, it didn't improve the situation one bit. And
right.
It is a really – that is, I don't see a solution for that country, to be honest, right now. It's gone beyond – it's finished. I mean, it's for political reasons, nobody dares to say that. But all the experts know that. But this country is finished. There is no.
Well, it's remarkable because you're talking about a country that has fantastic resources and could really have developed into something quite remarkable.
Yes.
Simply being destroyed by poor leadership and politics.
Absolutely. And a country which did not have, for instance, issues of separatism. Even if you look at the eastern regions, the Donbas, and even Crimea, look at the demonstrations that took place there. Even to protest the events in Kiev and look at the flags, the vast majority of flags, you had like 90-95% of flags in the demonstration were Ukrainian flags. You did not see Russian flags and you did not see originally, flags of the Donetsk People's Republic or stuff like that. That came after the military onslaught. So in reality, the country had a huge advantage. It was rich, wealthy, competent people, and it was it's an artificial country. But being an artificial country, it still was fairly united, and nationalism was not a big problem. The problem was that extreme nationalists from the Western Ukraine, and that really translates into neo-Nazis or, you know, bona fide Nazis, imposed their insane view of nationalism. As if I would compare that if the United States is a patriotic country, but it doesn't mean that it's run by the Ku Klux Klan. Well,
right
there, the local equivalent of the Ku Klux Klan came to power with Western support and started imposing itself upon everybody by violence. And that's what destroyed, eventually really finished the country off. And now it's too late to reverse that. I mean, the people in the East will never accept a Nazi regime over them. Crimea is gone forever. And I think that even the rest of the Ukraine, what's left today, will eventually collapse, probably into, at best, very wide regionalism, possibly into several countries.
Mm. How do you know what the depopulation has been since this started?
No, I know it's huge because people are emigrating as fast
right
as they can. I think it's 1.5 million towards Russia. It's probably at least as much, not out of the combat area, but out of the rest of Ukraine towards the west. And frankly, and I'm going to say something really sad here, this is the right thing to do. I always ask myself, what would I do if I had a friend in Kiev? What would I recommend to him? I would say pack and leave.
Right.
Because it's going to be horrible.
Right.
That's
right.
Really sad.
I agree.
It's a horrible thing to say, but I mean, I don't see right now anything good happening, at least for the Ukraine that's left now. I mean, Crimea will be fine. The Donbas will have a much harder time, but I think they will be fine. But the rest, I don't know. This is going to turn very ugly, very violent, and very, very poor.
While this was going on, I was very much watching what was happening with the payment systems and the U.S. effort to, and that's one of the reasons why I watched the satellites, really try and impose control of the clearing and payment mechanisms in the financial system. And then, of course, Snowden happening. And various parties in the BRIC nations and Russia doing everything they could to really begin to rebuild and build redundant financial systems so that they're not, you know, if we're going to have a multipolar world, then we have to have multipolar payment and clearance systems. And one of the things that it looked to me, and I can't point to too many things specifically other than how the Snowden revelations played out, it looked to me like there was someone very much at the top in the West, whether Europe or in the United States or both, who wanted redundant systems and didn't want to depend on the United States. And it looked to me like Putin was getting some pretty significant help from the West.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know about that. All I can say is the following, is that in Russia, I've identified there are two groups vying for power. My personal terminology is what I call one group, the Atlantic integrationists, the people who want to be part of the Western empire, or you could say mm-hmm. economy, etc., and what I call the Eurasian sovereignists, which are working towards that multipolar world. You could roughly say Putin being the latter and Medvedev being the Westerner. But what's often overlooked is that the entire economic segment of government in Russia is controlled by the pro-Western, pro-US, pro-IMF, pro-WTO group. It's Medvedev, it's the former minister Kudrin, but there are many more people. The head of the central bank in Russia, Nadyulina, mm-hmm. the vice premier Shuvalov, Dvorkin, Ulyukayev, Siluanov, Chubais, all these people are people who are completely, and you have to see Putin inherited them. When he came to power in 99-2000, he first of all inherited a system that was built by pro-Western people, and half of the, and all the key sectors economy-wise were run by people who were appointed and chosen and handpicked by the West during the 90s. And that combat has not been resolved. I mean, it's hard to estimate, but I would say about half of the power of the Kremlin is actually still not in Russian hands. And that influences Russian economy directly. There's a very strong struggle happening right now between those two groups.
Mm-hmm. And how would that affect? Because I always assumed that the Atlanticists would have help from the West.
Yes.
But that it wouldn't necessarily flow to Putin unless they were cooperating.
Well, Putin has to compromise with them. That's absolutely clear. He does things which all his allies object to and speak openly, but he has to keep a low profile on that because they represent a real threat. He still does not have one. It's funny when I hear that two things I love when I hear in the West is that the Russian media is entirely state-controlled, and the second one is Putin is a dictator. And I always, you know, sigh and go, if only that was true. Because in reality, well, and me being a paid Putin agent is the third thing, which I also wish I was true. Really, he controls certain sectors, you know, foreign policy, certain things. But what's big money, economic decisions, the ruble, Russian responses to sanctions, it's run by this Atlanticist circles. And they definitely have the support of us. This is why, you know, Kudrin was elected as the best foreign minister. I was told that Nabiurin had just got praise for being the best central banker. I mean, that's typical. These are people presented as heroes, as moderates, and they are the ones who are still the biggest threat to Putin by far.
Right. Now, I have been, Jim Norman has a wonderful book called The Oil Card and describes very much the effort by the national security state to bring the oil price down during the 80s. And contributing to sort of busting the Soviet budget with lower revenues. Of course, that advantaging China, you know, sort of the notion in the oil card is you bring the price up and you checkmate China, you bring the price down, you checkmate Russia. We've seen the price come down. It's now down 75% in the last 2 years. And that has to put an extraordinary bite on the Russian economy, along with the Russian or the sanctions that the United States has gotten both the United States and Europe to impose.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I have been amazed at how they seem to be managing very well under the face of that.
Well, because there's a couple of things happening. First of all, the sanctions and the drop in oil prices really is a wonderful opportunity for Russia because Atlanticists to do things they wouldn't do otherwise. So there again, we're dealing with, I think, one of the characteristics of the neocons generally and Western imperial power, short-term interests, never think ahead. And for Russia, it's a blessing because it forces Russia to do things to the economy to change it. Now, Russia has been, that economic sector has done many things wrong and many things are still to do. But the pressure is there, particularly in the public opinion and in the media, to react to that. And since Russia had big reserves, and Russia, their internal budget is all in rubles, Russia can cope with that situation. It can't cope infinitely, but a lot of people in Russia have the feeling that they can hold out longer than the U.S. shale industry or the Saudis. So there is actual optimism in Russia. The Russians think mostly, yes, it is a bite. It definitely is complicating tremendously, particularly the oil prices, yes, the budget and the revenue in Russia. But they're, first of all, they don't have an option. I mean, let's put it simply. If you're at war, you're at war. You accept suffering and losses. And everybody right. in Russia knows that. This is why after the sanctions were imposed and the economy took a plunge, Putin's popularity went up and not down, which the hope was that it would collapse. But that's not understanding the Russian mentality. They circled the wagons, and now Putin is around a ridiculous 90% of support because they accept that this is a war. They understand that. And secondly, they think they can't hold out because they have enough reserves.
Well, but it also speaks about the differential between the financial incentives of the leadership here, or the importance of financial incentives to the leadership here versus the in Russia. In other words, the what I would see is a group of leaders in the United States would break apart and run if they were targeted by those sanctions.
Yes.
I don't think they could stand in the face of them. And because you have to have a real sense of what we is. And that you're part, in other words, you have to understand what your equity is, whether it's your financial equity or your living equity. And if you understand the value of your equity, then you tell people to go jump in the lake when they try and smash it down because you know what it's worth. And, it, you know, and I don't just mean it's what it's worth financially, what it's worth, you know, in every sense of the world, because it's really, you know, you understand what the value of your civilization is and you just don't sell it for a dime or because, because somebody's attacking.
Yes, remember, another very important factor is that Russians are, on a daily basis, observing what's happening in the Ukraine. And the vast majority of them think this is the future the West wants for us. So if you look at the sanctions, yes, Russians have suffered under that economic plunge. But compared to the Ukrainians, they're doing great.
It was very interesting. I forget where it was, but I watched a video. It was sometime in the last year of Putin basically explaining to a large group of American media, and including the media that is the more sophisticated policy media, what was really going on in a situation. And you could tell these were people who've had to sit around and pretend that whatever the official story they're getting is true.
Mm-hmm.
And to have a world leader unpack the truth, you know, and try and force them out of the trance, the look on their faces was just priceless. It's almost as though he's ruining, you know, billions of dollars have been spent to come up with a world, you know, the best lies that money can buy. And Putin just keeps unpacking them. And it's very, you know, and the funny thing is, it's sort of one person with a couple of smart advisors unpacking billions and billions of dollars of lies, which this whole edifice depends on, and you watch it happen, and you have to laugh. I mean, I don't know if you've seen them. There are cars driving around in America that say Putin for president on the back of them.
Yes, I have. And let me tell you, you're probably referring to his 2007 speech in Munich, which... And his recent speech to the UN, yes, I'm aware of that support in the West because, in my blog, I get a lot of letters from most of my readers are actually American. And a lot of them write to me. I get a huge amount of letters. And they begin with words typically such as, I'm a patriotic American, love my country. A lot of them are war veterans, and they say, but now I have to admit that Putin stands up for American values and my leadership does not.
Right.
And you're absolutely correct when you're saying that Putin is destroying the myths that were built under propaganda. Remember that Putin is a foreign intelligence man. He understands the West superbly. He was trained to understand the West really deeply. He was an intelligence officer in Germany. This guy knows.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Oh, yes, he was an intelligence officer in Germany. So, and this is definitely the intellectual elite. The Foreign Intelligence Service of the KGB was people with superb education, language skills, I mean, history, everything. He understands the West really well, and this is why he's constantly, one by one, debunking the lies and bringing them down. And that is why he's so hated, because he dares to commit the ultimate crime thing, which is plainly say things that nobody else would dare to say. And that's why people in the West who, you know, have a sound, simple thinking like American patriots say, I like this guy, because he speaks straight and he stands for his values and he defends his country. And none of that actually triggers any kind of anti-Russian feelings in most Americans, I think, because they understand that. They would love to have a Putin here instead of Obama.
Right. Until they realize the financial ramifications of it. I told you by email one of the stories that I wanted to ask you about. In 2005, someone who was a national security advisor in the Putin group, I believe, but in Russia, came to a conference, a gold conference that I was speaking at. And, you know, and I spent a fair amount of time with him, and a fascinating guy, very cordial conversations. And then when we were flying back, he tried to recruit me. And it was one of the most impressive recruiting speeches I've ever heard. And basically what it said is, you know, our values come from the Orthodox Church, and we think in 1,000-year increments. And, you know, we're building something, and it's something real, and you're part of something that's not real, and all those people, you know, are trying to destroy you anyway. You know, so basically come over to your team. And it was fabulous, but it underscored the importance of the church. Now, let me tell you one thing, and then I'm going to ask you about the church. There was something amiss. I just, you know, and basically what I said to the guy is, I said, look, I agree with everything you say, but nobody likes a traitor. So that's how it is. So I'm not going over to your team. I'm just going to keep, you know, getting beat up by my team and stay where I am. So I went back to the, I got back to my office and did some research and discovered that Russia at the time was the number two holder of Fannie Mae securities. And to this day, I believe it was simply Fannie Mae trying to get me out of town. So, you know, so that's my guess. But I still think the Orthodox Church speech had some relevancy. So I wanted to ask you, how important is the Russian Orthodox Church to the values that are kind of being represented by Putin and the Russians in terms of its squabble with the United States?
I would say that, first of all, only a minority of Russians are truly religious people. The majority maybe call itself a nominally Orthodox, but it's more of a cultural, historical reference. I think it's not as much orthodoxy, you know, in a pure theological or sense of individual piety and practice as much as it is spirituality in general. For instance, I would definitely include Islam, Russian Islam, which Putin has very strongly supported, which played an absolutely crucial role in the rebirth of Russia because of the war in Chechnya, because the war in Chechnya was only stopped not only thanks to Russian military power, but also because there were Chechen traditionalist Muslims who stood up to the Wahhabis. And I think that I wouldn't say that Russian Orthodoxy directly is what feeds the difference in worldviews and civilization. It contributes to it, but I would say generally spirituality and respect for tradition. At this point in time, I wouldn't call it a pure religious revival, but respect for tradition, for spirituality, for traditional values, yes, definitely. And the West is perceived as being, frankly, I mean, you know, morally dead with no values. That's all the values of the West are basically hypocrisy. That's one of the things that most Russians totally agree on. Be it religion or be it democracy or human rights or free speech, all of that, in and of themselves, very good values. Nobody in Russia seriously believes, maybe except for, you know, 1 to 5% pro-Western people still exist, that these values are really true. And I think this is why so many people in the West, by the way, like Putin, because those who truly believe in these values, those people in the West who really do still hold on in spite of the dominant classes being against that to spirituality and tradition, etc., recognizing him a man who also stands up for that.
Right. There are many of us who believe the most important thing we can do at this point is try and preserve Western culture. So, but certainly the Russians would never have seen, you know, what they're seeing is not Western culture. So when I say Western culture, I mean things like the Scottish Enlightenment.
Right. And it all depends on what you're referring to by Western culture, unfortunately.
Right.
Because in Russia, a lot of that, they would also see as Freemasonry, as Europe united yeah. against Russia during Napoleon, during the Crimean War. You know, the papacy ruling by violence in Eastern Russia, I mean, in Western Russia. Depends what kind of, but the values, I would say, what today are called American values of democracy,
right.
you know, these values actually okay. Russians respect very much still. They really
yeah.
do. They have no problem with them at all.
So let's talk about migration, because I was in Europe for several months last year watching the migration, some of it, and now the reports are the volumes are growing even greater. I don't know if that's true. So I would love to know what your impression of the migration is, and I'm particularly interested in who in the world is financing it, because if you look at what's happening, somebody is truly financing this to happen.
The short answer, an honest one, would be I don't know. I have looked at what's happening in Europe on certain levels, and I'm horrified by that. But where the push came from and how it was organized, I hear from very well-informed people that, yes, it is organized, very well organized, that the mob in different countries helps people get to Europe. But who really is behind that, I honestly don't know.
Right. Right. What do you think will happen to Europe this year as a result of it?
I am very pessimistic for Europe. I think that Europe lost an ability to stand up for itself. I see Europe as an American colony, completely ruled by the United States. I don't believe that local politicians have any kind of say. And therefore, I don't believe that they're able to devise some kind of response, be it on, you know, I don't think they can devise an intelligence response in trying to stop the waves of refugees. I don't even believe that such a response is possible, because I think the pressure, what I call the osmotic pressure, is way too strong. These people are, if I was in these countries, I would also flee. that's how simple it is. I don't think they will be able to stop that. I think they brought it upon themselves, and I don't see a solution short term. There will be probably more violence, more social tension, and that will result in a curtailing of civil laws, and eventually the Europeans themselves will find themselves under semi-martial law, and it's being introduced step by step in several countries, restricting freedoms, you know, civil rights, and increasing police control. But will that actually succeed in protecting Europe from either terrorism or immigration? No, I don't think so at all. The solution for immigration has always been to address the causes of immigration. That's not going to happen.
Right. Well, if anything, the oil price dropping even more is going to make it worse.
Yes,
because you're going
absolutely.
You're going to have Northern Africa with less revenues and more incentive for people to go north.
Yes, and I don't believe that the parties who promise, you know, if we come to power, we'll stop that. You know, maybe in the UK because of the channel. But other than that, I know exactly what European borders look like. I can tell you they're going to be permeable. And Europe simply does not have what it takes to build, you know, a huge wall and then protect it. It's just not going to happen. Internal bickering is going to start. And for Europe to do that, it would have to break completely from its current, you know, colonial status. And the unfortunately, the people in power in Europe today have been chosen because they're spineless and don't have a vision. And I don't expect these people to come up with anything.
If you read the point of view of people who make the case that America is the strongest and has a great future, basically what they say is Europe will suffer from enormous chaos from this, but the United States is behind the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean, and has enormous agricultural resources and now is sort of close to energy self-sufficiency. And so it will be the island in this, you know, the safe island in the storm. Got any thoughts on that?
Yes, the weak link in this theory is the dollar and the willingness of people worldwide to finance U.S. deficits by purchasing dollars. I think that's the weak link here.
Well, the dollar price right now is high, but the dollar market share has been declining. And if you look at all the different infrastructure being put into place to create alternative payment systems, that decline is going to continue. Now, you have a short-term situation where the U.S. has lent dollars all around the world, and now they're essentially raising the cost of capital for dollars by raising interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
So they're basically putting the world in what I call a bear trap. So everybody borrows dollars. Now the price of dollars is going up. U.S. can print dollars. Commodity revenues are going down. And so everybody's over a barrel to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a short-term situation. Long-term, yeah, the more they diversify away. So if this is a model that depends on force, where does it end other than war?
Exactly. I want to say that, you know, the dollar used to be backed by gold. And after that was abolished, it became backed by what I call aircraft carriers. That's the big strength of the dollar, is that if you don't accept it, we'll bomb into smithereens. The problem is right now, clearly the U.S. military does not have the ability to continue to enforce that policy. If the U.S. can't even deal with Iran and now is failing in Syria, the U.S. is not going to be able to impose by military strength anything on Russia or China or India or all the countries who are slowly, you know, coalescing around that. So they will offer more and more alternatives to that, and eventually people will start just getting out, and the military threat will just not work. And the big question is, you know, will the U.S. Empire collapse with a little violence, because violence is inevitable, or, you know, in a massive worldwide conflagration? All I can say is that I hope and trust that eventually really the military will do what it takes to avoid that, the U.S. military, that is.
Right.
As for Russia, in 2014, I wrote an article where I said Russia is ready for war, and I really repeat that. I think Russians are afraid of war because they know what it is. They don't want it. They will do their utmost to avoid it, even compromising heavily. Russia needs peace and more than anything else. But if a war is forced upon Russia, Russia will fight. I am absolutely convinced of that. There's no doubt in my mind. So the U.S. will never succeed in bringing Russia into submission by military might. And I think it's also true for China. It's just not happening.
You had your latest piece on Iran, I thought, was particularly marvelous. We now just see the Iran deal finally click into place. And I forget exactly your headline, but basically, you know, it was Israel took a big hit. So
yes, oy vey.
If you could just touch on what your thoughts are on the Iran deal, what it means.
Well, I'm first of all amazed by it, because one of my biggest mistakes in predicting things and analysis, for years I've been warning about the U.S. war against Iran, and it doesn't happen, and I'm surprised, I'm delighted about it, but I'm really surprised it never happened. And I think that the Israel lobby basically used its influence to try to deal with Iran, and the Saudis too, by the way, because for both Israel and the Saudis, the threat is not nuclear weapons in Iran, it's that it's a different civilizational model. And they get away with openly defying both Israel and the U.S. That's the crime. And they're challenging the Islamic legitimacy of the House of Saud. That's the real crime. And they want Iran, you know, Iran has to be brought into submission. And that deal delays that. I still don't believe that the Israel lobby or the U.S. will accept Iran as a fact of life. I think they failed with this entire nuclear thing. They're going to come up with something else, be it a false flag or some fake, maybe terrorist atrocity blamed on Iran. But Iran, as it is right now, is just an absolute offense to the Anglo-Zionist empire. It is a country which just doesn't accept the rules and openly dares develop itself in spite of sanctions, in spite of the propaganda against it. And I think at this point in time, the Saudis and the Israelis have lost millions and millions and millions of dollars into trying to trigger a collision between the United States and Iran, and they failed. So for them, it's really oy vey. It's a horrible disaster that I think they're livid there. They're going to have to try to recoup and then think, well, what do we do next? Because just letting it happen is not an option either for the Israelis or the Saudis.
Okay, one more question. Have you by any chance watched a series of movies from the BBC called the Warwicker Trilogy?
No.
Okay. The first was done in 2007. The second two were done in 2014. It's about a MI6 intelligence operative named Johnny Warwicker. And essentially what it is, it's one of the most anti-American things I've ever seen come out of the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Very well done, very subtly done. But basically it's how the Brits are trying to destroy the global rendition system put in place by the CIA. And the implication is, of course, it's done fictionally, but the implication is that the Americans bribed Tony Blair behind the back of the intelligence services, for which they will never be forgiven. You know, it's kind of like we do that to the emerging market countries, but you don't do it to us. Anyway, but we've seen a number of different things happen that suggests a schism between the U.S. and the City of London. Now, I can't really tell what's going on, but traditionally the power of the U.S. has been very dependent on that partnership. And if the U.K. is showing distinct space and making deals around the U.S., I find that to be a very important and interesting situation. In fact, we've seen The Economist beating up on the U.S., and very smartly and rightly so, for the last 2 years on a lot of different policy issues. So, because one of my questions is the city where Putin is getting some of his strength from? I don't know. But there seems to be a crack in the Anglo-American partnership, and I find that fascinating.
To be honest, I mean, you're probably referring to things like, you know, the UK joining the Chinese bank, right? And the U.S. being left out of it, but or telling them not to do that. Honestly, I don't know. If there is a crack, then it's a sign of an advancing, that the collapse is further along than we thought, because there is infighting every time there is a crisis. When things go well, there's no infighting. But I don't think Putin would ever be an ally for the City of London. For Europe, yes. But there is an extremely acute sense in Russia that Britain is a formidable, very devious, and extremely dangerous foe,
yes,
particularly in the intelligence services. So they will deal pragmatically with it, but I don't think anybody in the city really hopes, you know, for Putin to prevail. Now, if it's just an internal thing between the U.S. and the U.K., that begs the question, well, where would the U.K. get military power, the city, for its operations? Because that's what the U.S. provided so much that Britain lacks. That partnership, that symbiosis was, you know, the banks in the U.K. and the aircraft carriers from the U.S. So it's hard for me to imagine that breaking up, although who knows? There are many things that happen that were hard to imagine.
Right. It's your beat, not mine, but it seems to me, whether the Donald Cook incident or the electronic blackout in Syria, the Russians continue to demonstrate, you know, significant ability in the weaponry area that is very important to what's happening.
Yes. They're definitely trying to convince the U.S. deep state that they have what it takes. They're also reinforcing. They're creating new tank divisions in the western directions. They're sending signals very clear, which is don't try it.
Right. Well, Saker, I can't thank you enough for joining us. And before we close, I want you to describe your website and describe your book and how to get it. And I just have to say, because I know you don't market, it's absolutely fantastic. If you're interested in what is happening globally, let alone what is happening in Russia, it is, not only is it a must read, but it is a very fascinating and entertaining read. Because I don't know how you managed to do it. Obviously, you're very knowledgeable and professional about the politics and the military aspects, the security aspects, but you always throw in these personal, oh my God, do you know how this makes me feel? you seem to weave in your feelings about these things, you know, in a very, I don't know, it, you know, it never gets too mushy, but it really, it makes for enormous entertainment. So, I really can't recommend your writing enough. So if you would just tell everybody how they find your website and how they get the book, I would appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thank you for your kind words. The website is thesaker, in one word, .is, which stands for Iceland. So thesaker.is. You can get the book. It's called The Essential Saker from Amazon or directly from the publisher, The Nimble Books. You can get it hard copy or ebook. Both are available.
Good.
And you can get it also on my website. It's advertised there.
And how often do you publish? And you're publishing other people too. So how often should we check in with your website?
On a daily basis. I try to get 3 to 4 new items every day. And I publish guest posts, which I think are very high quality. So I would recommend on a daily basis.
Yeah. Okay. Well, keep on doing it. You're great. Have a wonderful day. And thanks again.
Thank you so much. I appreciate everything. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.